A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everyone, Sam Willis here. Now, before we begin, I wanted to make a little announcement. I'm delighted to tell you all that I've teamed up with the excellent Bike Odyssey, a company with history and travel deep in its heart. They offer exceptional biking adventures. Bike Odyssey was set up by the historian, TV presenter and friend of mine, Sam Wood, who made the BBC documentary on Hannibal's Trail, and he subsequently dedicated his life to cycling in the footsteps of great historical figures. This autumn, I'll be joining their Venetians tour, travelling in the footsteps of Marco Polo. Come along and see for yourself why the Adriatic Sea is the most scenic coastline in the world. Along the way, I'll be sharing stories from my life of travel, adventure and research, as well as exploring the history all around us. It'll be a chance not just to immerse yourself in some of the world's most fascinating history, but to change the way that you think about the past. Now, if you want to find out more, just head over to bikeodyssey.cc. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show where we demonstrate that simply everything has its own history, like pitch, edges and bears.
Or keys, bees and fleas. Peas, pleas and pleas. They're two very distinctly different histories there. The history of pleasing people and the history of making pleas. It's all about... We'll have to do the research and find out.
Very good.
We will be following the links in our minds, as we always do as we come across them, explaining how those links fit together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, who knew that the history of doors is in fact about the afterlife, fertility and Viking conflict?
Yes.
Or that the history of keys, you know, the simple key, has a very complex history. It's all about power, secrecy, treasure, cloth, weapons and the Viking housewife. See what I've done there?
Yes, it's tremendous. The man sitting opposite me is the battle axe of the ages. It's Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. What a nice sunny morning it is today.
Lovely, isn't it?
The man sitting opposite me is the Odin of old times. It's the wonderful historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
As you can maybe guess from our introductions there, today we're going to be talking about the unexpected history of the Vikings. Now, we're doing this because... last year, James and I published our big book, Histories of the Unexpected, How Everything Has a History. And we've been a little remiss in doing our podcast as regularly as we'd like over the last few weeks. And that is because we have been writing a series of four books and in which we apply the idea of Histories of the Unexpected to various themes in history. We had done the Tudors, World War II, the Romans, and... you might guess it, we've done the Vikings.
Can I recommend to our listeners that you never attempt to write four books at once? Because they all come at the same time. While you're writing one, the proofs arrive, the copy edits arrive, and then all sorts of things arrive.
True. So at the moment, I've been going through the Vikings, but also trying to write the Romans, and also thinking about... editing World War II.
And I've been thinking about captions and the introduction to Romans and having to write 10 chapters on Romans.
Anyway, we're not going to whinge.
No time at all.
We're
not whinging. It's all fun, but this is why we haven't been as...
doing our podcast. And
yes.
It's actually been massively exciting. So each of these books has got 20 different chapters. And the idea is we take what you might think of... about Viking history, and we turn it on its head, essentially, and we come at it from a completely different angle. So I think before we start doing the unexpected stuff, where would you, what do you sort of think at the top of your head the Vikings, most people consider the Vikings to be about?
Traders and raiders, I think, is the big debate about the Vikings. I think most people see them as these sort of ferocious warriors, who come in from Scandinavia and move into. I mean, we're living in the United Kingdom, so we, you know, our traditional history at school is about how they invaded and took over large parts of our country, but also they went across to Vinland and went, you know, and throughout Europe and were very effective. Traditionally, they're seen as incredibly fierce. Partly because of the kinds of sources that survive in the Western tradition. So they tended to concentrate on attacking monasteries that were sites of wealth, and those churchmen, Christian, sort of saw them as these sort of heathen invaders. The other thing that we think about is of them as traders. You know, so one of the things that has sort of undercut this sort of vicious image of them is a sense of them as people who are merchants and traders. And I think increasingly our conception of them nowadays is much more complex. So rather than just these sort of vicious fighters and warriors, which absolutely they are to a certain extent, they are also farmers, fathers, sons, you know, people who live there.
Poets,
players, everyday life.
Yeah, musicians and all that sort of stuff. I think one of the key things, though, is the quality of the surviving sources about sort of the richness of descriptions of when they come onto the scene. There's the wonderful one from Alcuin of York. So in 793, this guy's a scholar and a clergyman. He writes to King Ethelred of Northumbria, describing the raid on Lindisfarne. So this is the not exactly the first time, but it's the first time it's really written about in any depth of the Vikings attacking England.
Brilliant.
Would you like to read it?
No, you.
Lo, it is nearly 350 years that we and our fathers have inhabited this most lovely land, and never before has such terror appeared in Britain as we have now suffered from a pagan race. Nor was it thought that such an inroad from the sea could be made. Behold, the church of St. Cuthbert spattered with the blood of the priests of God, despoiled of all its ornaments, a place more venerable than all in Britain, is given as a prey to the pagan peoples.
It's brilliant. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle as well reports the ravaging of wretched heathen men and the destruction of God's churches at Lindisfarne. It then goes on talking about that it sees them preceded by foreboding omens, including famine, whirlwinds, lightning, fiery dragons seeing flying through the sky. So there is this sort of sense that they are the apocalypse. And that's read in very sort of Christian ways. And the thing about the Vikings, I think, is also there it's very difficult to see them on their own terms. So often the written sources that survive are the people that they attacked. Mm. So obviously they are skewed in a particular way.
Yeah.
But we do have this fabulous saga literature that comes from much later around in Iceland. And that's a sort of fascinating source. You know, that it's much later. A lot of it is about its myth and tradition, its oral tales that have been passed down the centuries and eventually written down. But the difficulty that you have is how do you relate that to what has happened some 400 or 500 years before? Are there echoes of the material culture and beliefs and social practices of the Vikings? It's very difficult to study, and people have made whole careers out of this. The other major kind of source that is right up your street is the archaeological evidence that survives, which is quite extraordinary.
Well, it's some of the most amazing things that have ever been excavated, I would say.
Having just written a book on the Romans, I think they would come very close.
Yes, I think so. But I mean,
inkwells.
Those are amazing. We'll come back and talk to them about the Romans. So the point is, you've got some well known traditional sources, and people have been looking at the Vikings from perspectives of raiders and traders, as we say. And you've got this whole conversion to Christianity, so you can look at it from terms of religion. You've got all the kings, you've got the women, you've got the houses, you've got the ships. There are various aspects which are kind of are more traditional to approach the Vikings from.
And in terms of period, we're talking roughly 8th century, so early 8th century, there are certain sort of movements in settlements. By 793, you've got Lindisfarne attacked. 794, Iona. 841, you've got a permanent Viking settlement in Dublin. And from there on, you're seeing greater degrees of settlement throughout Europe.
Yeah. And so you can study it from a geographical perspective. You can study it from time. You can see how they affected and how they mixed with different people as they came across them. In that respect, it's very much like the Romans, isn't it? There's a kind of a history of empire here. Yeah. And how the different peoples associated with each other. However, James and I have decided to work our unexpected magic on it. So are you ready? These are the topics we have come up with for our book on the Vikings.
Should we do one? Take it in turns.
No, I'm not going to read a list. Go on. And then we can just talk about them a bit. Because we're obviously not going to go through the whole thing. But to give you an idea of the intellectual explosion of joy that this has given us, we have written...
Chapters on.
Keys.
Graffiti.
Nicknames.
Mischief.
Hair grooming.
That's excellent. Hot spas and saunas.
Break-ins.
Colour.
Toys.
One of my favourites. Teeth.
Doors.
Goading.
Criminal profiling.
Birds.
Luck.
Friendship.
Fun.
Double standards.
Silk.
And staffs.
As in wands.
Ah, I like where you're going with that.
So each of these is massively significant to Viking history. And we've been trying to bend our brains around exactly how, and it's been really enjoyable. James, what are the things that you've had fun doing most?
So I want to talk about two things today. I want to talk about graffiti and toys. Graffiti for me is all about Viking travel, mm-hmm. because what you notice is that throughout the Vikings travelled. They left graffiti wherever they went. So it's either runes or rough marks or short phrases, symbols, pictures. And in a world where paper is pretty scarce and you can't find survival of literacy, you're finding that this sort of graffiti enables us to study Viking literacy, but also travel around the world. And it crops up in the most unusual places.
So we can see where they've been because they're leaving graffiti.
Because they leave graffiti.
And we can understand their literary levels because we can see what they've written.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So there's graffiti in the Hagia Sophia, which was the capital of the Byzantine Empire, which is a sort of nowadays a mosque, but was a cathedral. And there's a range of Viking graffiti that's left there. There are some runic inscriptions. There are the names of two supposed Viking warriors, Halfdan and Ave. There are also a series of drawings of Viking longships that can be dated to about the 9th and 10th century. Yeah. And we know that there's contact between the Byzantine and the Viking empires during
this
period.
Two of the key maritime powers of the period, is worth saying.
Absolutely.
So there's no surprise that there are links there, but it's wonderful to have the evidence of it.
Yeah, yeah. So we can see that they end up there. There's also in Venice, near the arsenal, there is a lion, a Byzantine lion, that has a massive runic verse on it.
It's so cool.
It's absolutely brilliant. And they didn't just get to Venice, but this lion was taken as plunder from Piraeus, the Athenian port, in 1687, when it was taken
by the Venetians
as war booty.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's set, and the graffiti is very difficult to read nowadays, but tons of scholars have had their go at it. And the nearest that we've got is the following: they cut him down in the midst of his forces, but in the harbour the men cut runes by the sea in memory of Horsey, a good warrior. The Swede set this on the lion. He went his way with good counsel, gold he won in his travels. And this is thought to have been carved by one of the Varangian guards, so this kind of super elite bodyguards that guarded the emperor. It also crops up in Orkney, of all places, where it is in a cairned tomb.
Yeah.
And there's a connection there with Vikings who are travelling, and I think it's about the 11th century, and the 12th century.
Orkney at the time, you might think it's slightly out of the way, but it's like a service station on the M4.
isn't it?
I think that's exactly as it is. It's a stop off point on Viking trade route.
So they're going from
Norway.
Norway or Denmark, Sweden, you know, that whole kind of area, across the top of Scotland, onto Iceland. And it's a lovely spot to stop and refuel or to shelter from storms that you get in the North Atlantic.
To quote from our book, Orkney was in the middle of the principal Northern Viking maritime highway.
Sounds like one of my sentences, James.
Certainly does. But what's fascinating about this is that it is in this Neolithic chambered tomb where these men seem to have sheltered for the night, and there are about 30 different examples of Viking graffiti on it, which range from the light-hearted to, frankly, the sort of slightly obscene. And we get a number of personal names. For example, Ofram the son of Sigurd carved these runes. Hermund Hardax carved these runes. Trigger carved these runes, the Viking equivalent of modern-day tagging. Slightly more bombastic than those two is the following phrase. These runes were carved by the man most skilled in runes in the Western Ocean. But also there are some that are sexually slightly more explicit. Some that have been translated as thorny f***ed Helgi carved. Ingigerth is the most beautiful of all women. And this appears beside a picture of a slavering dog. And so it goes on. There's one that reads, Thatir the Viking came here too weary, which sort of conjures up this idea of the Vikings absolutely knackered after their travel. So Viking graffiti is all about travel and literacy.
It is. I think a couple of really interesting things there. One is the guy who wrote in runes that he was the best person at writing in runes.
Yes.
I really like that. It's pride in education.
Rather like yourself saying that Orkney was the middle of the principal Northern Viking maritime highway, being your line rather than mine.
Well, no, I meant it was a maritime theme.
We, of course, write in one voice.
it's pride in Viking literacy and being able to master the runes, which
yes,
I think is fantastic.
Absolutely.
And the other thing I love about the story of the lion in Venice with the runes on it is that the runes are no longer readable.
Yeah.
And we are entirely reliant on copies that were made in the 18th or 17th century.
In 1861 was one of the first.
Oh, okay, 19th century.
First times they were.
But yeah, but often with things like this, you're not looking at original documents, even when it comes to runestones, and people have taken, you know, rubbings or sketches or drawings of them. So it's a case of really standing on the shoulders of giants, of historians who've been there before you. Or they're not necessarily just historians. They're just kind of like, a lot of them are just sort of kindly travellers who decide to write something down because it's interesting.
Anoraks.
Yes, anoraks. Yes. 19th century.
Historical anoraks.
Historical anoraks. And here we are. And I really like that. It's good. It makes you feel like you're doing something that has its own history.
Yes. Where are you going to take us now? What have you been interested in?
Oh,
what's your fave? What's one of your faves?
Goading.
Oh, goading. Good. You don't mean that, you illiterate son of a gun.
I do mean it.
No, you don't. I bet you can't even read. You can't. Certainly didn't write it.
Right. Goading is fantastic. It's all to do with challenging the power of male authority. So these are females within the Viking world winding up their males in their lives and provoking them and trying them to get them to do stuff.
This is one of my favourites, actually.
Thoroughly enjoyed this. There are examples of taunting wives or goading wives, taunting mothers. And what they're doing is they're wielding words like a Viking would wield an axe, I suppose. Trying to provoke their assailant to action. And there are a couple of wonderful quotes, just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, from the sagas. Well, this one's from Laxdæla saga. We've got a Viking woman called Gudrun who's winding up her husband, trying to get him to take revenge on his foster brother who's scorned and rejected his wife. It's slightly complicated, but here we go.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much.
But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
With your temperament, she begins. This is criticizing his inaction, his doing nothing. She says, you'd have made some farmer a good group of daughters, fit to do no one any good or any harm. After all the abuse and shame Kjartan has heaped upon you, you don't let it disturb your sleep while he goes riding by under your very nose, and with only one other man to accompany him. Such men have no better memory than a pig. There's not much chance you'll ever dare to make a move against Kjartan at home if you won't even stand up to him now, when he only has one or two others to back him up. The lot of you just sit here at home making much of yourselves, and one could only wish there were fewer of you.
Oh, that's gotta hurt.
It's brilliant, isn't it? I mean, that... I think the one example that immediately springs to mind of that kind of amazing invective is from Shakespeare.
Yeah, yeah.
Dickens has got some cracking examples, but Shakespeare's is truly wonderful. And I think it owes a lot to the wonders of the saga writers. There's another one here. So this is, someone has been wound up to attack this guy called Kjartan, and then Kjartan's mother has a go at him. Actually, no, she has a go at the rest of her sons. Marvellously, unlike your noble kindred, you turn out in that you will not avenge such a brother as Kjartan was. Never would Eagle, your mother's father, have behaved in such a manner, and a piteous thing it is to have dolts for sons. Indeed, I think it would have suited you better if you'd been your father's daughter and had married. For here, Haldor, it comes to the old saw, no stock without a duffer, and this is the ill luck of Olaf. I see most clearly how he blundered in begetting his sons.
So she's trying to sort of incite her sons to revenge the other son's death.
That's right, murder. Yes. It's kind of a complicated family tree of death and revenge. And so she's trying to do that. But, and there's a fair bit of misogyny in there as well.
There is misogyny in there in that they're disparaging daughters.
Yeah, and they do it in both of those quotes. Yeah,
but also what it is, it's trying to attack the masculinity and the honour of these male warriors. You know, to basically say that they're effeminate, that, and they should sort of, you know, be slightly man up and deal with the situation.
So what's great about these is that on the one hand, you've got examples of women challenging male authority, but then you've got to think about who actually wrote the sagas.
Yes.
And the sagas were all commissioned by men and written by men.
Yes.
And one of the really fascinating ways of looking at these examples of goading and taunting, which I really liked actually, was the idea that by describing women as goading and taunting, what they're actually doing is they are removing the blame for the murder, the misdeed, from their own shoulders. They're saying, oh, well, someone else made me do it. It was my evil wife or my evil mother. And so there's a real kind of aspect of men sidestepping the blame for horrifically violent acts and blaming it on women.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because on one sense, you've got that sort of misogynistic underculture, subculture there. But also, these are occasions of female power.
Yeah.
So these are very sort of powerful role models that we're being given. And of course, they come in the saga literature, so it's incredibly difficult to relate them to everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to recover the history of Viking women, you know, through written sources like this, because you're often dealing with stereotypes. And so when often often what I find has most inspired me about this is the dexterity with which the archaeological evidence is used to reconstruct women, in particular on the chapter on staffs. So the idea of the prophetess, which I think we've spoken about in the past.
Let's just go stop there and talk quickly about staffs. So staffs for us were all about...
Staffs were about magic.
Yeah.
Magic and female sorceresses. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yes.
And so originally people thought that they interpreted... So staffs had been discovered in graves. People thought that they were to do with like roasting spits or...
Roasting spits or simply staffs that people had. And if you have a look at the archaeological evidence over the last 100 years, that seems to have been how staffs were classified. Whereas there seems to have been, over the last couple of decades, feminism seems to have been breathed through. It's almost like archaeology has discovered feminism.
Yep.
And suddenly you're able to reorient the way in which people categorise those particular finds.
So in this example, they're saying that the staffs were, they're linked to sorcery, they're linked to very powerful women.
Very powerful women, seers, people who are prophetesses, who are able to predict the future, and that these, in a sense, are wands that are used to cast spells. There's been a whole range of archaeological finds that have allowed them to sort of think in these ways. And I think that's an example of how we've spoken elsewhere about the importance of the historical imagination. And when you have so many gaps in the literature, in the documentary sources that survive, in the archaeology of the period, you know, it's about thinking cleverly and thinking imaginatively. And, you know, in this sense, it may be applying feminist theory that gives you a different perspective. But suddenly you're able to reconstruct the very rich lives of Viking women.
Yeah.
What I'm interested in is also toys, the history of children.
I loved your chapter on toys.
I loved my chapter on toys. It was one of my favourite. I mean, the history of childhood is something that has, as a sociocultural historian, is something that's always really interested me. And I've worked in different periods on the history of children's letters, for example. But with the Vikings, the problem is that children are often really invisible.
So yeah, for you, toys were all about
toys were
hidden
all
children.
About hidden children. Yeah. Absolutely, they were all about hidden children.
I love that because it goes to the heart of unexpected stuff. Because you said toys were about hidden children, and I just said, "What are you talking about?"
Exactly.
I have completely no idea.
And here you think about children as across the life cycle, so babies, toddlers, infants, teenagers. They are so difficult to find.
Yeah.
In the hidden record. If you'd read through the sagas, you might find occasional glimpses of children playing with toys. Mm-hmm. Sometimes even girls are referred to, but, you know, quite often they are absolutely absent from this. There are very few graves that survive. One of the main sources that we have for Viking archaeological culture and material culture is grave finds.
Yeah.
So the idea that people would have been buried most of the period fully clothed and with goods to take to the afterlife with them, which allows you to have some sort of sense of the everyday objects they'd have had. Now, what this means is that we need to look at toys in order to sort of reconstruct the history of childhood. But toys themselves are incredibly difficult. How do you define a toy? Mm. Rather than something that is a miniature, so either used for religious purposes, it's maybe a sort of votive offering, you know, it's a sort of collectible.
Yeah,
it's like Lemmy out of Motorhead, God rest his soul, who used to collect Kinder toys.
Right.
Did you know that?
Didn't know that.
But I think the Metal Man used to collect Kinder toys. So, you know, so even though you have something that's very small, a miniature,
it actually makes me think of Tangled. You know that she does her song in the pub.
You mean the Disney show, Tangled?
The Disney show, yes. Tangled, that she does her the
Rapunzel.
Yes, and there's a huge oaf who collects ceramic unicorns.
Yes, that may well be it.
That's, I think, that would have been inspired.
That was,
by,
in fact, my inspiration for
Motorhead.
This chapter.
But the point is, if there's a small horse that you find in a grave, it might just be a small horse.
Yes, it might just be a small horse. But
or it might be a child's
having
toy.
Said that, there are certain graves that you can identify as child's graves, and there are in graves that are associated with young boys, they've found small swords, boats, querns, so those sort of big grinding stones. And the idea that what the archaeologists have sort of said is that actually what these are, it's part of the socialisation of children. Yeah. So you have a boat so that you learn the arts of navigation. You have a small quern so that you can grind. What's more difficult is to actually discover girls' toys. Because girls, I think, are doubly invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because women in Viking history seem to be more invisible than men. But also, how do you identify girls' toys? If we look at some of the grave evidence, you can find there's a grave in Birka, for example, that's been identified as a girl's grave. And there is a doll in it, there are clothes in it, and there are also things like needles. And from that, you can get a sense of sort of roles within the household. So the doll is associated with, I mean, it may have just been a doll to sort of play with as a child could play with, but also it's often associated with role-playing motherhood. And also the presence of a needle suggests needlework and being trained to sew for within the household. The other thing is, if we're thinking generally about children's toys, you don't necessarily need anything that's been fashioned, like a sword or a doll or whatever. Children will literally pick up almost anything and start playing with it.
Yes, and that, then it turns into a toy with what they're doing with it rather than what it's designed to be.
So it's about their imagination. And that, I suppose, that's the real challenge for you. It's how do you recreate or reconstruct childish culture?
Yeah.
So you can look at the presence of objects. You then need to go, what do they do with them?
Mm-hmm.
And then how do you get at the child's imagination out of that? And that's where the gaps and omissions are. It's really hard as a historian to actually do that.
Yeah. I really loved... I think the gaps and omissions is really... It's something that goes to the heart of what we do. But it's also key for doing this. And one of the things that makes me think about this is the chapter on Viking break-ins. I mean, you raised it and you said, oh, I'm going to write something about Viking break-ins. And I had no idea what you were talking about. And you were talking about people breaking in to Viking burials.
Yes.
And so there's evidence that the break-ins happened maybe a generation or so after, sometimes quite quickly after.
Yes.
The actual burial was put in place. But it wasn't just about stealing. It's not grave robbing necessarily as we think it was, but there's a much more complex thing going on here, and we argue it's all about power politics. So people are visibly attacking significant archaeological sites within the landscape and they are breaking into them. And it's not something that happens in the dead of night. It takes a long time, takes several days to actually go in, dig out a hole into the grave, get what you want, and come back. And they were doing it so that people could see them do it.
Yep.
And what they were taking is really interesting. So archaeologists have identified what has been taken from what's not there. So that's another example of these the gaps and how clever people are doing, especially swords, weapons, things which might have had a certain amount of power. So where they would expect that to be present in a grave and it's not... And you can make the assumption that someone's actually gone in there and taken it out.
Yeah, but also taking out skeletons and skulls and stamping on them very publicly. So the idea is that basically one of the purposes of these sort of huge burial mounds is that they are symbolic representations of that family's power base in that region. When that particular group of Vikings gets overthrown, a new group of Vikings move in, and so they desecrate that area and put their own stamp and identity on the landscape by basically building their own tombs instead. So it's a really, there's some one terrific work done on it. I wish, if I had my time again, I think I might well be a Viking scholar.
Yeah.
Rather than a Tudor and Stuart specialist.
Well, I've always been fascinated by different alphabets, and runes was something that I was always interested in.
Yeah.
So I could have done that. I love the mystery of it all. A lack of curves is interesting, particularly with runes.
A chisel, isn't it?
All straight up and down.
Yeah.
I think we've given everyone a very good taster there. I mean, one thing I wanted to say is how varied all of the different sagas are.
Yes.
And how, as a historian, some of them are particularly good for their depictions of honour, marriage, revenge, reconciliations. Others are good for myths. Others are good for toys. Others are good for games. Some are good for the Irish. They've all got their own little
swords,
their own little strengths and weaknesses.
Yep.
So some have battles in, some don't. Some have this in, some don't.
Yep.
And kind of getting your head around that was really, really important. I mean, I think I went into it and I assumed that they were all not necessarily of a similar value, but they kind of covered the same sort of topics. But of course, they don't at all. They're utterly unique in what they describe and who was in them. And because of the historian or the chronicler who actually wrote them down, I think they wrote down what they were interested in as well. So they reflect all sorts of different aspects of Viking society. And I've loved that, really kind of enjoying the kaleidoscope,
yes.
I think. The kaleidoscope of the Viking world. And you only really get that if you look at all of the sagas. So if you look at one, you're like, well, that's kind of interesting. But if you look at 20 of them, you're like, wow, there's so much different stuff and so many different ways that you can get into it, whether it's by saying break-ins are all about power politics, colour is a code in Viking life, and all of the, fun's all about Viking strategy. We found all this out from the sagas and mixed with the archaeology.
Teeth are about identity.
Teeth are great. They're really interesting. Yeah.
But in order to discover that, you'd better read the book, which is out. When is it out, Sam?
In the summer.
In the summer? In July?
In the summer. Before we go, I'm just going to tell you a few things about what we're going to be doing over the next few weeks. So I think the next few podcasts, we're going to do one just like this. We've done the Vikings. We'll do one on the Romans. And then we'll do one World War II. And then we'll do one on
the Tudors.
And then we're going to go back to the core of Unexpected. And we're going to be doing specific subjects.
What do you fancy doing? I want to do voices.
History of voices.
Yes.
You said that. I shouted at the dog when we went into the studio here, and you said, oh, we should do voices.
Yes, we should. And I saw Susie Lipscomb's The Voice of Neem.
That's absolutely there. We've got a copy here.
Yes, we have a copy.
So that is Susie Lipscomb's new book, The Voices of Neem. And that's like,
so I'm looking forward to reading.
It's about recovering
lost
voices of women in 16th century France. So we're going to do voices. We're going to do breath.
We're going to do walking backwards.
I'm so excited about this. I cannot remember.
I want to do boredom.
We're doing boredom.
Just swearing.
Quickly, walking backwards. I came across this when I was on a trip to Chatham Dockyard and looked around the ropery there and realised that the people who made the ropes spent almost all of their lives walking backwards. And I suddenly thought, oh my God, can we do a history of walking backwards? And of course you can do a history of walking backwards, and we're going to prove it.
History of walking backwards is also about the Romans and their scorched earth tactics as they retreated.
Oh, that's good.
They burnt the crops, sowed the ground with salt.
Yeah, yeah.
And moved to different places.
I want to do the history of no.
Yeah, that sounds good.
I want to do
I was trying to think of something funny to say there, but couldn't off the top of my head.
The history of
swearing.
The history
of swearing.
Negative.
Fingers. We've done hands. Fingers.
Neediness.
Oh, neediness. Oh, my God. Are you a needy person?
Glass.
I
am sometimes.
Glass. Glass would be good.
Glass and boredom, which is going to be tremendous.
Wood. I'd like to do water.
Mm.
Wine. Beer. I mean, there's so many.
Should we do a little run
of spirits?
Yes, whilst tasting them.
Of drinks, yes.
I think we should listen. Thank you all very much for listening. That was immensely good fun, as it always is, sitting in my shed with the Daybell.
We didn't do keys.
Keys, oh, that's so interesting.
Housewives.
Yeah.
Power.
It is all about power and control, keys.
Yes.
The Vikings had tiny keys, like you'd have for a little secret diary.
Yep.
They found loads of keys, and the keys are useless. The keys don't work in locks. They are symbolic keys.
Terrible keys.
Anyway, listen, it's a good book. Pre-order it on Amazon. Off you go. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on iTunes. It really, really helps. And we're on a bit of a mission to make everyone think about the past in a different way. And we can't do it without your help. And that's one of the things that you guys can do. So please get involved. Also, do tell your friends and let us know if you're enjoying it. Tell us on Twitter. You can find us. I'm on Dr. Sam Willis.
And I am on @JamesDaybell. And you can follow Histories of the Unexpected on @UnexpectedPod.
And you can find out more about what we've got planned in the coming months. All sorts of extra stuff at historiesoftheunexpected.com. If you haven't come to see us live, do please come and see us. James and I have nearly done 40 shows. And we are having a wonderful time doing it.
We've got a busy summer. We're going to be doing all sorts of festivals. festivals and theatres.
Festivals and theatres coming up.
Events.
And then more and more and more. The podcast, the book's been turned into a live show by a friend of mine who's a playwright, and it's full of props and it's completely hilarious. And we've been enjoying it more than anything else we've ever done.
And one of the things that we are really inspired to do is to inspire young people to get interested in history. So if there are any teachers and schools listening to this and you would like to get involved with what we are doing, please get in touch with us.
That's it. Thank you so much for listening. As always, we all love you to bits. Get in touch. Bye.
Okay, bye.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.